Welcome to Life as a Patient Doctor. I'm your host, Stephanie Moss, navigating life as a patient and a future MD. Walk alongside me as I reflect on the challenges and lessons I've learned undergoing medical school with invisible disabilities. Join me as I interview other doctors, students, and healthcare workers on their own journeys. Listen to their unique stories on how they have balanced their health while caring for others in the health profession. Today, I'll be going over my own journey with being diagnosed as a second-year medical student. Now, I've had the opportunity to talk about this in different capacities on different podcasts, but this is my own podcast, so of course, I have to share my own journey. And specifically for this, I'll be using some of my work from the Endo Foundation article, which was actually one of the first places that I wrote about my journey and kind of opened up, especially regarding disability disclosure. This is the location where I did that original disclosure. I published it in December 16th, 2021, and it was The Connection Between Pelvic Pain and Childhood Trauma, A Medical Student Tells Your Story. Now, for this one, I won't talk about the trauma. I'll just more talk about my diagnosis. The trauma part will be for another episode, and please go ahead and read the Endo Foundation blog post. I wrote it in both English and Spanish. So I wrote, even though I experienced abdominal and pelvic pain since puberty, I visited multiple physicians who were unable to properly diagnose me. My experience was a mix of medical gaslighting, misdiagnosis, and not taking me seriously for being a young Latina with minimal family support. It wasn't until I became a second-year medical student that I acquired the knowledge and medical advantage or privilege that allowed me to stand up for my own needs and get properly diagnosed through specialized medical care. My unique position as a medical student was a privilege that allowed me to advocate for myself in a way I never had the confidence to do before. In the fall of 2020, I was finally able to get properly diagnosed with endometriosis with tubal occlusion through laparoscopic surgery. Additionally, by the time that I wrote this post, I was going through IVF follicle stimulation with the goal to freeze embryos from when my husband and I completed our residency training. So, first signs of pain. In middle school, my passion for science led me to do my own research at our own local library on the pain that came with my period. After a few weeks of casually snooping, I found the shelf with books about teenage bodies and puberty. I would nonchalantly grab one of the books and rest it open on a separate bookshelf as I pretended to be looking at fiction books. But really, I was quickly absorbing all the information I could on puberty. I never had the chance to fully read each book, but for many months, I skimmed them from the back corner of the library's teenage section. Whenever I heard my parents' voice, I would jump up off the ground and pretend to be looking at the spines of various other library books. Unfortunately, my self-research knowledge was never enough to answer all my questions. Naturally, my friends were the next source of information. One day, my middle school friends and I were chatting about all of our menstrual pains. Everyone seemed to have different levels of pain and for different number of days. In our middle school health class, we were told that premenstrual syndrome, or PMS, is the start of becoming a woman and was supposed to be painful. This concept of pain was similarly normalized by my peers. One of my friends expressed that she had such bad PMS that her mother even allowed her to stay home at least once a month. I was so jealous of her that she could ditch school just because of pain. Even though we were all expected to deal with pain as women, I felt that my level of pain was pretty similar to hers. But I rationalized that I must be stronger because I could live through the pain. My PMS never stopped me from going to school or even participating in my karate or martial arts workouts. That's definitely going back to me being a martial artist and having to toughen through the pain, having to be strong and tough. I remember reading that pain could be overcome by exercising and pushing through it. Therefore, I became very involved in my martial arts training. Even though our instructors tried to mentally break us through hours of fitness training, my hardened mindset of not letting physical pain affect my mental state allowed me to strive under pressure, which was not a good thing, let me say. You should never, never struggle or push through pain. Never. Eventually, my abdominal and pelvic pain caught up to me. On my 15th birthday, while I was also testing for one of my upper black belt ranks, I was first degree black belt. I think I might have been going for my second degree black belt. I was like in the middle of between my first degree and second degree black belt. So during one of these testing, long day testing cycles, I experienced such severe pain that I just could not ignore any longer. When I began to feel the pain, I instinctively swallowed pain meds before jumping back on the karate floor to spar. And spar is where we put on all this gear and it's like a point competition, or we do it within like 2 minutes with a partner. Not long after, my partner and I started kicking each other, but then I collapsed on the floor with tears running down my face. Everyone circled around me, but I kept repeating, "Oh, I'm fine, I'm fine." Although one of my adult mentors said I might have appendicitis, so I was rushed to the hospital. After some pain medications, blood tests, a CT scan, I was just sent home with a possible diagnosis of an ovarian cyst. Just so you know, everyone can have ovarian cysts. That just means that your ovary is preparing to release an egg. That is a normal thing. Now they can enlarge to a significant amount. And then when they ovulate, that can hurt. So that's probably what they were saying that I could have. But there is a misconception that this is abnormal. Not everyone has pain when you ovulate. So that should have been already a red flag, and is actually a common thing that individuals with endometriosis can come into the emergency room in pain and are frequently dismissed. This episode of intense pain continued every couple months, mostly in my lower right abdominal cavity or abdominal area. During severe episodes, I sometimes even called the nursing line to ask if I should go to the hospital. The nurse or physician on call always resorted to just saying, "Oh, it was probably ovarian cysts, PMS, or ovulation." And they just recommended I take pain medications and use a heating pad, which is very sad, especially if someone's in that much amount of pain, you don't want to be too careful. So usually we do ask them to come to the hospital or at least try other strategies first. And if those don't work, then go to the hospital. A little bit of science about it. Painful periods, medically diagnosed as dysmenorrhea, is actually very common. And that's not a good thing. That's just saying it's common. 50 to 90% of reproductive age women experience pain at some point, which is McKenna and Fogelman 2021. And I'll link that article. However, even though abdominal pain is a common problem, doctors and physicians are required to confirm that the pain is not severe nor caused by another medical conditions. Non-steroidal anti-inflammatory drugs like ibuprofen or sometimes even acetaminophen or hormonal contraceptives like birth control pills, shots, IUD, and implants are usually first-line medical treatment for pelvic pain, the 2021 article. Unfortunately, since my parent removed me from the doctor's office after my doctor mentioned birth control pills, I never had the opportunity to explore other treatment for my pain. So a lot of it was self-treatment with pain pills. And I'll talk a little bit about what ended up happening, which is a consequence of having ever relying on those over-the-counter pills, because they're supposed to be for a temporary solution and not a chronic pain. When I finally became a legal adult, or 18, I finally had the opportunity to take charge of my own healthcare, also because I could actually drive around. Once I turned 18, I used the money from my martial arts instructor job to pay for doctor's visits, co-pays, and medications. This included being able to visit a doctor who prescribed me birth control pills for my pain. When I began college, I continued to explore the cause of my continued pelvic and abdominal pain by making appointments with various doctors and specialists. One physician suggested it was probably just my bowels getting stuck, which was normal for skinny girls like me, which is very sad that someone said that. And that's called gaslighting, of ignoring the pain. Bowel should not get stuck. Or even if it does get stuck, that would be a medical emergency. Another doctor told me it was just constipation and told me to eat more fiber. Another gaslighting. Yes, fiber is important. That won't solve pain. That would just make you maybe more regular. This led me to set up an appointment with a gastroenterologist, which is a doctor who specializes in intestines and bowels. After hearing my symptoms, this specialist scheduled me for a colonoscopy to check my large intestine for any physical manifestation that could explain my pain. And I want to mention, I'm 18 years old. That's really young to be getting a colonoscopy, but some health conditions can be diagnosed by seeing the inside of the colon. About a week before my colonoscopy appointment, my abdominal pain suddenly manifested into nonstop vomiting. I remember this. This was in college, my first year of college. I was rushed to the hospital after my vomit turned bright red with blood. I remember that. I had my mom quickly pick me up and then pick up Jonah, who was my boyfriend at the time, my current husband. I just remember holding a bag and just vomiting. Probably should have called an ambulance, but it was terrifying because I just could not stop. And if you've ever had to like hold and vomit, it's a natural urge to want to get rid of it. Especially that pain was coming out. It was really painful. And that is definitely a medical emergency. The vomit was quickly aborted with medication when I got to the hospital, and I was given IV fluids with an IV to combat dehydration. After telling the emergency room I had an upcoming colonoscopy, it was decided that they would also do an endoscopy to look into my stomach and intestines during the upcoming appointment or procedure. This meant that under anesthesia, we would have a camera go down my throat, through my esophagus, and look at my stomach and small intestines to see if there were any holes or cuts or reasons for the blood or even tears. Thankfully, I was going to be asleep. This is a common procedure that we do. Again, so young. Should have been, again, another red flag. Why is this young girl? This is the correct thing to do. You're vomiting blood. Figure out why and stop the blood. I remember going into colonoscopy. No, I'm going to start off preparing for the colonoscopy. Now, if you've ever done a colonoscopy when you're asleep, that's okay. But the prep, everyone talks about the prep, and I will agree, it was disgusting. This was about almost 10 years ago now, and it was like a huge jug of powder, and it just tasted disgusting. And you have to drink all of it to clean out your intestines, to diarrhea it out, which is gross on that end. But the actual flavor of it, the one that I had 10 years ago, was disgusting. Now, if your doctor says you need a colonoscopy, don't worry, there are other ways that I've learned in being in medical school and having another colonoscopy recently in the past year. There are other ways to make it not taste as bad, either mixing it or actually they now have pills that were covered by my insurance. I'm not sure if it's covered by all insurance, but there are pills that are like very strong salt tabs that you just swallow and does the exact same thing, but you don't have to taste it. And like I said, the taste just makes you want to vomit. So especially because of my health condition, it was very painful to go through that entire prep, which again, it's not supposed to be. And then when I actually got to the colonoscopy, I remember laying down, I was awake to get into the bed. And then they looked at me and like, aren't you too young to have a colonoscopy? And then even I remember one of the techs said that I was the youngest they'd ever given it to, which I remember, I don't remember how I felt at the moment, but it felt really bad. It wasn't like a good thing. It wasn't a positive thing that I was the youngest. Maybe they were trying to do it as a funny thing. I sometimes do that, try to joke with patients, make it like a lighter experience, but being a patient myself, I recognize now that like making fun of this when someone's so stressed is not always the best way. And you really have to read the situation, make sure you're respectful with what you're saying. And maybe there are other ways to decrease the stress or the weirdness of the situation. So I remember going to sleep and then waking up. Unfortunately, the colonoscopy did not find anything out of the ordinary. However, the endoscopy, so the one that went down, colonoscopy goes up, endoscopy goes down. The endoscopy did find, they found 6 ulcers. 6, which I always like to tell people that because it's pretty impressive in the negative. People don't normally have that much. And I'll talk 2 kind of reasons why I might have, but let's keep going. So they found 6 stomach ulcers throughout my lower stomach and the first part of my small intestine, which is called the duodenum. And the doctor was beyond himself. He said he had never seen so many gastric ulcers. And he said I didn't meet the 2 most common reasons for ulcers because he did the biopsy and it was negative for H. pylori, which is bacteria that is most common for ulcers. And then also ibuprofen, which now looking back, like I was saying, I did take pain pills, but I usually took acetaminophen. So that is more possible. And I know in our household, we usually had acetaminophen. I wasn't just taking ibuprofen, which does decrease the stomach lining. It makes it super thin and increased chance of those ulcers. I usually had acetaminophen. So it was very odd. So that led to stress was the cause of my ulcers, which as a pre-medical student, there was stress there. I had chronic stress growing up. And also I had just started my first year of college, moved out for the first time in my life. There is a lot of stress. In the past, doctors had explained away my stomach and abdominal and pelvic pain as a manifestation of stress because I was a pre-med student and was apparently supposed to be stressed. However, ulcers manifesting from stress did not make sense to me at the time because I didn't feel overwhelmed or stressed. But it wasn't until later that I started learning about health conditions and learning about the chronic impact of trauma and stress on the body. And that's most likely what could have caused me to have physical manifestations of those ulcers. We'll talk about later my other health condition that I was diagnosed, but at least for that, that could explain the stomach ulcer stress. And there's actually many, many studies and research that demonstrate the direct correlation of chronic stress on the body. And what happens, there's release of cortisol, which is a stress hormone that leads to a decreased protection of your body against foreign invaders and the mishandling of the immune system against your own body. And it kind of develops like an autoimmune type disease where the body can start attacking itself. And that's kind of where like the stomach ulcers come in when there's decreased amount of protection in the stomach and increased amount of stomach acid that stomach acid can break down the wall. So all that being said, the discovery that I had gastral and duodenal ulcers would just be the start of my medical conditions as a trauma survivor and medical student. However, in order to uncover them, I would need to surpass the pervasive medical gaslighting and medical community, which didn't have a lot of education regarding sexual and pelvic pain, which is now one of my passions as a future health professional, is increasing advocacy and education for the medical community and for patients on these pain conditions. Next, I'm going to talk a little bit more about medical gaslighting before I got to be in medical school. And this will be a multi-part. So this will be the part 1 and part 2 will be when I'm actually a medical student. So stay tuned. So medical gaslighting. In college, I received pelvic and intravaginal ultrasound to rule out different medical conditions. I remember holding back tears as the ultrasound tech shoved in the probe. She told me to hold still, but all I could do is tell her she really hurt. And she joked with me that I must be a virgin. And I also heard other doctors have told other patients, like, drink wine or calm down. These are not respectful nor educated things to say to patients. But it's an unfortunate reality that I've seen myself and I've heard and I've spoken with other patients who have struggled with any type of pain during these ultrasounds. And it's an unfortunate reality when you either are going to have a baby, you're going to do IVF, you're just trying to see if there's something wrong with your ovaries or uterus. It is something that it shouldn't hurt. And if it hurts, then this can be a health condition. And so please see a OB-GYN, a urogynecologist, a PM&R specialist, which is a physical medicine and rehabilitation doctor. Those are specifically trained to determine why you're having pain on insertion of the probe or having pain by putting on a tampon. These are all conditions, signs of some sort of health condition. It is not all in your head. Pain is not normal. You'll hear me say that again. I will scream that at the top of a mountain. Pain is not normal. No matter the pain, that means your body's telling you something's wrong. Now, not necessarily that there is something physical that's wrong. It could be the nerves firing, muscle spasming, but you shouldn't go through pain unless this is for a procedure to see what is wrong. So there should have been definitely more coaching, more helpful ways to help relax in a more respectful way to do things. Over the years of struggling with hormone pills, struggling with different doses of birth control pills, I decided to ask my OB-GYN for an IUD, which also can help for individuals with painful periods. However, I was not prepared for just the excruciating pain. What happens when we put in IUDs, we have to open the cervix, which is supposed to be closed unless you're actively having a child that is actually birthing, is very close. And so to push it open does cause pain. Some sort of uncomfort is common. It can cause pain. And thankfully, this OB-GYN, the second time I did it, he actually local injection to relax and numb the area. However, not OB-GYNs do it. And so definitely ask your OB-GYN if they can do it. If they say they don't do it, go to another doctor because it is ridiculously painful if you have a health condition like this. I remember squeezing my now husband's hand as it turned white, and I felt my gown soaked with tears as the doctor opened the cervix, just maybe like 1 centimeter to place the IUD inside. So that must have been the first time because the doctor suggested that next time I take ibuprofen. Now, as a medical student, I'm not going to say hundreds because that is not true. Maybe like 10 IUDs. And then I've watched a lot through my OB-GYN rotation, my family medicine rotation. I've helped put in IUDs, both copper and the progesterone ones. And when we do it after someone's given birth, it's a lot easier to put them in because the cervix is already opened. However, definitely seeing patients go through it, there is a mix. Sometimes it was pressure, uncomfort, but the couple of times I did see the patients were in pain, I asked if we could do injections. Ones that I'd worked with were uncomfortable doing it. And so I know it exists because I had it. I have worked with some providers who do it or recommend doing other medications to relax the body or decrease the cramping. So talk to your health provider about other strategies, especially if you have that experience or worried about that experience. Let's talk a little bit about racism and how this could correlate with gaslighting. Over and over, medical professionals discounted my pain and suffering as either normal or they just assumed I was exaggerating. I couldn't help but think if they believed it was because I was a young Hispanic girl who was just crying for attention. This substandard care is an example of racial discrimination, which is unfortunately prominent across the healthcare field. Racism is, in fact, a fundamental determinant of health by creating social inequality in how medical professionals interact with patients. I'll link the article, which is Prather et al. 2018. The racist negative stereotype of women of color being aggressive, angry, or complaining frequently prevents medical providers from taking them seriously and addressing their healthcare concerns. again, Prather et al. 2018. These examples of discounting my own pain were examples of medical gaslighting, a term used to describe when medical providers treat their patients like their suffering does not matter or isn't as bad as they say. However, I had no concept of medical gaslighting, nor that it was inappropriate or disrespectful. Unfortunately, it was a common way that I had learned how we talk, and that I didn't know that that was a disrespectful way to talk, and that I didn't deserve to be treated and talked like that. Because I grew up in a household that we're not allowed to feel or express emotions, and that is kind of the emotional temperament, and that I wasn't allowed to complain if I was having pain. The next time I visited the OB-GYN, I was shocked that he had remembered the pain during the last IUD insertion. He must have wrote it down in his notes, which is great. In addition to giving me pain medication orally, he gave me a local anesthetic while removing the current IUD and placing the new one. After telling him that this was the last time I would see him because I was going out of state for medical school, he suggested that I look into a rare condition called endometriosis. He said the only way to properly diagnose it is through surgery. But he said I was too young for surgery, so don't worry about it. Just think about it maybe after my medical training. And I trusted this wise doctor who actually delivered me. So I put the diagnosis in my backpack for later. And I wouldn't hear this term for another couple of years until I was in medical school. So stay tuned for part two as I will learn how going to medical school actually helped me finally get diagnosed and for my pain. Not to say I didn't have gaslighting, because I definitely still have gaslighting, which was interesting. It changed when I was a medical student, but I was still a female, still Hispanic. So stay tuned for part two. If you want to learn more about resources, I've been collecting them over my entire experience of how to live with different health conditions and pelvic pain and abdominal pain and sexual health. And so check out my website, medpsychmoss.com, where I've collected all those resources and really hope they can help you and others, whether if you're a patient, a family member, or a healthcare provider. If you haven't listened to my other podcasts, check them out on Spotify, Amazon, Apple Podcasts, YouTube, both audio and video. Additionally, I also interview other health professions who are both patients and health providers. So check those out. And you can follow me on MedPsychMoss. So stay tuned for part two.